Welcome to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein in studio with my co-host Ashley Thornburg.
Hello.
In the second half of today's show, we'll hear from Rick Guillen, our weekly series with Rick Prairie Plates. We'll start talking about Easter brunch, but we may end up talking about our relationship with food. But first today, Ashley, it's a little bit of a bittersweet day. We're going to talk about one of our great friends.
In the second half, you'll also learn about an upcoming celebration for Sue Balcom's birthday that is happening in the midst of some health concerns.
But first, Ashley, have you read about Kate Middleton?
Well, of course.
Haven't we all?
And I think anyone who's not living under a rock has seen she's been both in the tabloids and the news lately with a recent cancer announcement following weeks of mass speculation about her sudden disappearance from public life and royal duties. Now, that speculation and the fact that she's been in both tabloids and legitimate press publications, well, it made me start to wonder about information in general and the difference between disseminating information and spreading gossip. And then that made me think about gossip in general. Is it good because it helps you suss out who you can trust? Or is it bad because it undermines social cohesion? It's time now for Philosophical Currents, a look at why we're talking about whatever it is we're talking about.
Including Kate Middleton, right?
Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein is my guest, a professor of philosophy at the University of North Dakota. Jack, thanks so much for joining us today.
I'm happy to be here, and I was really excited that you mentioned a celebrity that I didn't have to look up. So I'm already a couple steps ahead of the game than I usually am.
Do we want to start right there with why this person is considered a celebrity when there was a point in history when royalty was revered?
This is really interesting because it switches the idea from a hard power to a soft power. There was a time when the aristocracy was in charge, where the king was a military leader and made the laws. And so the king and his family were people who you had to be aware of because they affected your life profoundly and in ways that you can't prevent. Now, royalty are celebrities. They have a soft power. They can influence through example. They can influence through social pressure. They can set trends and nudge. And so if some of the royalty wants to have a political opinion, they have to do so subtly or in a way that doesn't affect legislation but affects the populace. And so I think a lot of this has to do with just the changing role of what royalty was and what it is now, particularly in the United Kingdom.
Well, and then stretch that out to the United States, which is not even a part of the Commonwealth. And yet, you know, on NPR's website, this is getting significant coverage, and we are not even ruled. We had a war over not being ruled by the United Kingdom and not having a monarchy at all. So what does it say about at least contemporary U.S. society that there are still a lot of folks talking about this and specifically in legitimate news sources in addition to sort of being tabloid fodder?
Well, Kate Middleton has the trifecta. She's rich, she's attractive, and she's white. And this is also the same kind of thing that motivates coverage on missing children. Mm-hmm. We know through the history of media that children of color, poor children, their disappearance doesn't matter as much. But if you get a JonBenet Ramsey or something like that, it becomes a sincere focus of people's attention. People aren't going to investigate King Charles in the same way that they're investigating Kate Middleton because she fits a visual image and she fits a cultural slot that we are used to jumping into.
That Western ideal.
That's that Western ideal, but also that love and interest of our betters, so to speak, right? Mm. We think that the rich are better than us. We think that Brad Pitt is better than us, or George Clooney, or whomever is relevant these days. We think they're better than us. They have an exciting life. They get to go wonderful places. They've got money. They've got sex. They've got everything. And so many of us want so many of those things that what we can do is live vicariously through them. So now something happens that isn't wonderful but is tragic. And our vicarious living helps us both feel a little superior, but also very empathetic, because what if this were me? What if this were someone I know? Cancer is egalitarian disease. You can be rich, you can poor, you can be attractive, you can be unattractive, what have you. And so the power shifts a little bit, and now we are in the enviable place and she is not.
Is the coverage of her news or gossip?
Well, I guess it's a little of both, right? It's news on a slow news day. It doesn't compare to the collapsing of the bridge in Baltimore or something like that. But at the same time, it's of interest to people. Now, gossip in itself is an industry. Kate Middleton is an employer in the sense that lots of people make money off of her the way that they make money off of Taylor Swift. They sell t-shirts, they sell posters, they write articles, they do all these things. So in one sense, this is the news industry and an economic necessity. On the other hand, gossip is a very interesting bridge between the public and the private. Gossip is the way that we talk about things that aren't necessarily on the surface supposed to be talking about. So it's not simply that Kate Middleton has cancer. It's that Kate Middleton has cancer, but some people don't trust that and think that something else is going on. Conspiracy theories are soap operas that we play in our head, and we're constantly looking for the reveal. It would be really interesting if it turned out that Kate Middleton didn't have cancer, but had given birth to triplets from a secret lover or something like that. People would love that because it's more exciting and it's more positive than cancer. There is something private about a medical diagnosis, and there is something very isolating about suffering through an illness, because no matter how many people are around you and love you and hold your hand, it's you and your mortality. And so the fact that this is gossip is a way that we can connect our private and our internal lives with the public in a way that doesn't quite sanction us talking about it. So talking about it in and of itself is kind of titillating.
I'm not sure if this is genderism or just a natural consequence of me being a woman and more of my friends who are talking about this also being women. But, you know, you saying that it might be more interesting if she gave birth, you know, to triplets because of an illicit lover, whereas most of what I'm hearing in terms of gossip, if it's cancer, it might be HPV that was caused because of a philandering husband. Or, nope, this is a deep fake. She's already dead, or she's being thrown under the bus by the royal family. And there is a desire to make the entire royal family, but most specifically Prince William, a villain here. What do you make of that?
There's a couple things going on here, right? The first is, again, that soap opera thing, and villains are more interesting than the good guy, right? And there's the always punishing gender attitude that women in the public eye are deserving of being knocked down a peg, and clearly we can attack her for her sexuality or what have you, especially, again, because she's conventionally attractive. But gossip has almost always been the main purview of women in society, because women weren't in charge and they didn't have, to use that language again, hard power. What they had was the power of intrigue, the power of whispering, right? If you are a king and you have a harem with 50 wives, the wives are going to be talking to each other and you're not going to know what they say. And this is how wives communicated with one another. This, in fact, goes back all the way back to the classical Greeks in the Western world, because women were required to stay home most of the day, and then for 2 hours in the evening, they were allowed to socialize under the watchful eyes of their male family members.
Oh, there's so many words in that sentence. Allowed,
yes.
Watchful.
Yes, what's interesting to me, and this is a side note, is that I actually didn't learn this until about a year ago, and I've been studying Greek philosophy for my entire career. It is a well-kept secret because we idolize the Greeks so much. We want them to be a model of democracy. But the fact of the matter is that misogyny is probably the oldest prejudice. And women have always found ways to use what they have to have power themselves and to have power over the people who allegedly have power over them. There's a great line in the movie My Big Fat Greek Wedding where one of the women says, you know, the man is the head of the family, but the woman is the neck. She turns the head where she wants it to look. And gossip is a tool that can destroy or can celebrate. It's something that can give and something that can take away. And so women have always used that ability to talk to each other in secret, especially in places where men aren't, say if they're being isolated because the culture has purification rituals for menstruation or something like that. Men are not going to be there. And so the women can talk and control and manipulate. And I don't mean that in a negative way. I just mean we all make the most of what power we have. And because the history of our cultures is predominantly a patriarchal history, the women are going to find ways that don't involve swords and tanks and legislation. They involve something else.
We're visiting today with philosopher Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein. He is a professor at the University of North Dakota and the host of Why? Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. And we're talking about the role of gossip in our lives. Jack, can gossip be looked at in sort of one of three ways here? Is it sort of middle ground, it's a harmless social lubricant, something we do at the bar or at the water cooler at the office, or this is destructive? You know, there is evidence out there that rumors have been what have started war and big headlines that caused action and behavior. And does that undermine social cohesion, or is it good because it can build trust? If I tell a secret to someone and I never hear about it again, I can trust that person. If I tell a secret to someone else and then it comes back to me and likely manipulated, I know I can't trust that person anymore.
What's so interesting about your question is that it can not only be all three, but it can be all three at the same time.
Mm.
Gossip is a tool, and like all tools, its use is as complicated as the human beings who use it, right? A hammer can be something that we use to pound a nail. It can be something we use to defend ourselves, or it can be a sign of companionship between generations, where the mother or the father handed down the family hammer because they're all carpenters or something. Mm-hmm. It can mean anything you want. And the thing that is so interesting about gossip is, like the written word, once you let it out, you have no control of it anymore. And this is where the game of telephone comes in, and this is where your example of it, gossip coming back to you, you finding out it means something else now, comes in. Because once our words leave our lips, other people can repeat them in any way that they want. And that's why, you know, there have been times in my life where people have come up to me and said, you know, oh, I heard you said this, or, you know, why did you insult me that way? And often my response is, well, I'm deeply offended that you think that I would even say such a thing. Mm. Because first of all, I'm the kind of guy that tells things to people's face. But more important than that, you know this as a fact, right? But more importantly, it's easier to believe things about people when the people aren't in the room. It's easier to believe that Kate Middleton has some other disease or triplets or something than it would be if we were standing next to her and she's attached to the machine that goes bing, right? It doesn't. The second someone is absent, your imagination, which holds their identity, it's in control. And so there are a lot of things that I would hear about other people, or that other people would hear about me, that wouldn't make any sense looking into their eyes. I remember a long time ago, we had a friend who everyone was saying was having an affair, and Kim and I were responding, oh, she'd never do that, blah, blah, blah. And of course she was having an affair and everyone knew it, and we didn't. So it goes both ways, right? You can think that a person is worse than they are, but you can also think that a person is better than they are. And that's the power of gossip. You can hold on to it to have any meaning you want, and you can adjust your imagination to believe anything about anybody, because in your mind, anything is possible.
Well, this becomes then a question of the power of belief. And if we want to keep it specific to the Kate Middleton story that we're talking about here, I know people who, as soon as they saw the video of her saying that she has cancer, immediately said, that's a deep fake. She's already dead. They Diana'd her, which already says that they believe that the royal family murdered Diana and that they're doing this to Kate. And they just have already decided that. It sort of comes down to the belief in the stories that we want to hear anyway. It's almost more like public relations versus journalism. People go where they want to be led. People believe what they want to believe in stories like this.
I think that's a really important insight to connect it to public relations because, of course, the royal family made a crucial mistake, and that is they released a photoshopped picture. And everyone knew that that photoshopped picture was off because it got widely reported and the hand was in a weird angle or something like that. And so the moment you lie once, then everyone believes you're lying all the time. Hmm. The moment you are discovered and exposed, then the natural question is, what else are you hiding? What else are we going to discover? If they had come out in the very first diagnosis, even when there were no visible signs and Kate had said, listen to me talking about her like I know her name, you know, personally, Kate. Well, yeah. Kate had said to me, you know, I have cancer. I'm going to start to look terrible. I'm going to hide myself from the public eye. I apologize, but can't we be private about this? People would be more accepting and more believing. But because they tried to hide it, then it opens the door to what else are you hiding? And so some of this is that we live in the time of conspiracy theories. But some of this is bad public relations and a misstep at the moment when it was most important to get it right.
When you said, I'm sorry, in that speaking in her voice, I really had to say, should she have to apologize for something like this? But it brought me back to an early answer where you talked about, you know, the role of people like this having the soft power to influence. And is there a trade-off here? Do you have to give up a certain level of privacy in order to harness the incredible soft power that someone like her wields?
So there is an expectation of perfection or more that we impose upon her, and that by being in the royal family, she uses to her advantage. And when she falls short of that, there is something that wants us to, there's something in us that we want to hear an apology. I thought of, while you were asking the question, the song from Evita, where Evita Perón is singing about how she let the people down. And the lines, if I remember correctly, are, don't cry for me, Argentina. I was supposed to have been immortal. That's all you wanted. It's not much to ask for, right? People want their leaders, their stars, their celebrities, their idols. They want them to be perfect. They want them to be immortal. They want them to be unscathed by impurity, and they're not. The difference, I think, or I don't want to say the difference. What is interesting, though, particularly in both the American and the English character, is that the only thing we like more than a rise to the top is watching the fall back down to the bottom.
Oh, what does that say about us?
We love building up our celebrities and then watching them collapse. And
okay,
is that...
talk about that more, because you also earlier said, because the villain is more interesting than the hero, and just sort of like point blank accept that as fact.
So there is a tension in the fact that we see these people and they have that wealth, that power, that beauty, that sex. And there's part of us that live vicariously through them, but there's also part of us that want, I don't know, universal justice, this idea that they have it and we don't. So you know what? They don't deserve it. If I don't deserve it, they don't deserve it. So watching them get their imagined comeuppance makes us feel better about not having those things, because all of this is about our emotional state. All of this is about the way that we feel about ourselves when we look at ourselves in the mirror. And if someone as, let's say, talented and successful as Britney Spears has a breakdown and shaves her head, then we can say, oh, she was crazy all the time. I'm better off being where I am. Not to mention just the sheer entertainment value. Some of this is escapism. Some of this is the escape of our own mundane lives or our own troubles and our own problems. And we can enjoy the drama because we have chemical reactions in our brain. And it gives us good feelings or makes us excited or what have you. Celebrities are people who we impose meaning on. And when they violate that meaning, it causes us to react in ways that are surprising to ourselves. I think about, and you and I talked about this on Philosophical Currents before, I think about when Will Smith slapped Chris Rock at the Oscars. It instantaneously changed public opinion on Will Smith, and there was something invigorating about that. At that point, Will Smith was just a nice guy and we wished him success. But then all of a sudden, he's this complex, dark guy who's in an abusive marriage, and we can shift our sense of who the villain is from him to her. It becomes a Lady Macbeth situation. And we can start thinking about it again, so we have more fuel for our escapism. Human beings want entertainment. We want a tremendous amount of entertainment. We are tirelessly looking for entertainment, and our own lives are rarely entertaining enough because what we are, for the most part, is exhausted and frustrated that we are not the rich and famous
people.
So
does everybody just have delusions of grandeur and incredible imaginations? And is that bad? Is that just literally what it is to be human?
Everyone is the center of their own universe. I do this.
Oh, there's a word for when we realize that that everyone else is the star of their own universe.
Well, I do this exercise with my students where I say, I'm the center of my own universe. Watch. And I stand in front of them and I spin in a circle. And I say, see, everywhere I go, I'm in the middle, right? We are experiencing creatures, and we experience through the I, through the self. And everything in the universe that we experience is filtered through who we are. So it's not narcissistic to say that we are the main characters in our own lives. It's just true. The thing that we have to do and the moral lessons that we have to both learn and impart is that just because we experience ourselves as the center doesn't mean that we are in fact the center. And the central rule of ethics that every ethicist imparts in one way or another is we are not special. The rules that apply to us apply to other people, and the rules that apply to other people apply to us. And the Kate Middleton saga is a way of telling us that even Kate Middleton isn't special because she too can get cancer.
Always an intriguing conversation with philosopher Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein, a Chester Fritz Distinguished Professor of Philosophy at the University of North Dakota, and our go-to for Philosophical Currents when we take a deep dive into why are we talking about the things we're talking about. Jack, thanks as always.
It is a pleasure.
And listeners, I did have a chance to Google after that conversation the word I was looking for a minute ago about when you realize that everyone else is thinking about themselves as the star of their own story. Sonder, the realization that each random passerby is living a life as vivid and complex as your own, in which you might appear only once. Happy saundering, everyone.
Still to come on Main Street, Easter brunch. That's after this.
I like bagels.
Have some salad.
All I eat is pizza.
Eat some barbecue.
Apple sauce and some nice red beets.
All right, who is hungry? I have a suspicion, Ricky, on that you might be. Rick joins us once a week for Prairie Plates. How you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you, Ashley?
I am well and looking forward to Easter. and talking about gathering over food and values. And I love when those two things come together. So what's not to love about Easter?
Everyone loves it.
What is always on your Easter menu?
There's a lot to it. Easter brunch is eggs, meat, smoked salmon, waffles, pancakes, salads, desserts. It needs to be colorful. It needs to be vibrant. It needs that sign of spring.
Yeah, that's what I was just about to ask. I love me some comfort food, but I'm kind of ready for anything green at this point.
Anything green is good, yes.
Give us some tips. Yes, there's an Easter brunch at basically every church and every restaurant this weekend, but for those doing it at home, elevate our eggs, would you?
I really like a good egg bake. Culturally here, people do too. Mm-hmm. It's just one of those things in the upper Midwest that I think that we really enjoy.
Well, it's an easy one too.
It is, and you can make it different ways. You can make it like a frittata that's thinner with some herbs in it, that sort of thing. Or you can make a really thick egg bake. You can do one with kind of soaked pieces of bread. People do that. They soak the eggs in some bread overnight.
Yes. I love anything that rescues bread.
That one is very good. I go to a marathon party every year. It's eggs, soaked bread, and like Jimmy Dean sausage and cheese, and that's really good. A lot of things you can do with eggs. It's a very versatile thing. Soufflés, that's delicious.
If you can manage it. It's hard to get that rise.
It is, and you can't look at it and open the oven, and all of those rules that they talk about are true.
Those are real. What about just a good poached egg?
I like poached eggs on top of potatoes, corned beef hash, even some like wilted greens, spinach, garlic, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Poached eggs, you got to watch to not overcook. If you like the yolks runny, you really kind of have to watch it. I like to poach it simmering water, maybe a little bit of vinegar or pickle juice in there.
What does that do?
It makes the egg coagulate a little bit and not just kind of go all over the place. I'll also swirl the water just a little bit, not super violent, but it helps kind of form a solid egg.
Moving on to the main dish, you've mentioned ham, lamb, sausage, bacon. These kinds of things tend to take the center stage at Easter.
If you're at home, a leg of lamb is really good. Bone in, bone out, it's really good. I really like to tie it in butcher's twine, kind of put some herbs and garlic in the inside, butterfly it like that, roll it up, butcher's twine on a charcoal grill. And you can do indirect heat and that sort of thing, reverse sear or sear and move it over method.
What's a reverse sear?
Well, you're going to cook it at a lower temperature or on a charcoal grill. It's going to be on indirect heat for a while and just let the fat melt in the meat. Like if you're doing a prime rib roast or something like that, that's the big thing these days is a reverse sear. And then you make the grill hot on one side again and then sear the outside and get that nice crust. Whereas previously you'd sear it and then move it over. And that technique is a long time technique and works really well too. But people like the reverse sear because they feel like it melts the fat and connective tissue and stuff and just that delicious, unctuous sort of flavor. So,
well, and it's a brunch too. So you do have to have some breakfasty elements in there. The waffles, the pancakes. There's a special place in my heart for refined carbohydrates.
Oh, absolutely. Yes, absolutely. And waffles versus pancakes, that's your choice. I'm kind of into Swedish pancakes these days.
A little thinner.
A little thinner, yeah.
Yeah, do you roll them up?
No, I kind of just eat them. They're kind of in one bite. They're so small.
Okay.
And crepes are good, too, if you're into the French thing. I mean, you can roll crepes up. Mm-hmm. You can do them kind of stacked. You can make them into a cake, actually. But
do you need a special pan?
No, you don't, but sometimes people will buy these to do them right at the restaurants. They'll buy like a really large flat griddle and do things with different kind of sticks and utensils so they can make them large. But at home, a nonstick pan really works well with a little bit of butter in it. And that's the way I've done it. And I do French omelets that way too. French omelets use a little less egg, some herbs in it. Make sure it's thin and then you can roll those up with a little bit of cheese or whatever your filling is.
And salads. We both mentioned, okay, yes, we need to eat something that has like freshly sprung up from the earth.
Yes.
And, you know, this recent snowstorm, maybe not helping us advance that now, but some good greens out there.
I would really look at some organic fresh greens. You're picking them up at the grocery store. Look at them. I look at them kind of, if you can, smell them, whatever. But fresh greens this year really, I think, kind of brighten the mood. They're just something that on the side of an egg bake or like Eggs Benedict, for instance, if you had a little greens, fresh green salad, it's really good.
There's a trick to kale, isn't there, that has something to do with, I don't want to say macerating, but crunching kale. Did I make this up?
I slice kale really thin, like ribbon cut it. And then some people will blanch it beforehand.
Oh, fascinating.
Some people will saute it a little bit. I think it has a lot. Some people just like it like pulled apart, ripped apart, small, and that takes a lot of time. But yeah, with kale, the larger the pieces, the harder it's going to be to chew. And those stems, they're pretty much impossible to chew.
Yeah. Well, I feel like it changes the flavor a little if you interact with it like that, too. Am I just insane?
No, you're not. And it probably decreases the nutritional value if you, you know, if you're going to blanch it first or something like that because they leach out into the water. But for me, if I put kale in a salad not cooked, I will cut it in ribbons, just like roll it up like you would basil kind of, but in a larger fashion and make it into ribbons so you can chew it. It's hard to chew.
Did you say roll it up like you would basil? I've never rolled basil.
Yeah. If
What am I missing out on?
If you chiffonade basil, you kind of just roll it up and then cut it into ribbons with a sharp knife. So you don't bruise it and turn it dark. But if
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about that. This hands-on interacting with food. Food is the number one longest relationship you will have in your entire life. And far too few of people interact with their food.
My biggest suggestion would be to get some really fun tools to use because it makes cooking a lot more fun and it can get a little expensive, but it doesn't have to if you watch the sales and that sort of thing. Yeah, I mean, the process of going through that, of cooking, eating, all of those things really makes them great memories. And my big tip is I own a lot of knives and pans.
And you keep them sharp.
That's another good tip, yeah, because in the long run, a dull knife will slip and probably injure you.
Well, finish us out here with just a good Easter dessert.
When you think of Easter dessert, I think of muffins, banana breads.
Why?
I don't know.
Why Easter muffins?
Something about a blueberry muffin or a lemon poppy seed muffin and a little bit of butter. Yeah. But pie, I can't deny pie.
Well, yeah. And why would one?
And bars are good. In the upper Midwest, we love our bars, and you can make a pie into a bar pretty quickly.
I love when people turn a dessert into just a different dessert. Yes. Well, we talk with Rick Gion for Prairie Plates once a week. Thank you, Rick.
Thank you. And one other thing. Don't forget the kuchen for dessert.
And of course, we always love talking about food with Rick, but his spot is a spot that used to be filled with this.
If you can go outside nude and garden, then it's time to plant your tomatoes and your peppers.
Wonderful advice from the always fun, wonderfully sagacious, and a bit flamboyant Sue Balcom. That was, of course, our beloved Sue, known to listeners for Main Street Eats and known across the state for her deep commitment to food and gardening. She's long been active in gardening and in farmers markets. Craig, I tell you, I once saw her bake dozens of loaves of bread in one day, and she wasn't even in a commercial kitchen. This was just her home, but boy, can she really throw down on sourdough bread. And let me tell you, the next day she was sold out of bread. And when I buy pickles from her, I do not tell my husband because that way I don't have to share them with him.
smart move. Actually, I have gotten to know many people here at Prairie Public since I've started working here just over a year ago. But Sue was absolutely and is absolutely one of my favorites. I need to tell you a story. When my wife and I were just thinking about moving to North Dakota, we were making a trip here from Wyoming, and we turned on Prairie Public. The first thing we heard was a Main Street segment with you and Sue.
Aww.
We listened to the entire segment. My wife and I chatted about it, and we felt good.
Right.
Sue is a wonderful person. She was a joy for me to talk to because I knew not a lot about the great things that you guys share, but she didn't make me feel bad that I didn't. We had a lot of fun, and we do have a lot of fun when we get to visit with her.
Yeah, that's really an interesting spin on someone who is so deeply knowledgeable and yet always finds the fun and the good. And this idea that you would go out and nude garden, I just love
it.
It's
that time of year, here we go.
I'm pretty sure she's done that.
And who puts spiders on their Christmas tree?
Right? Yes, she does. And now she has had to back away from Main Street Eats and much of the other work that she has been doing.
And I'll say, Ashley, real quick, I miss her.
I do.
I really do.
I do.
I know you do.
I'm excited to go and see her on Saturday. So she had to pull away from this work following a lung cancer diagnosis that has unfortunately metastasized to her brain. This Saturday is her birthday. I'm going to get the chance to go see her along with many other people in the Bismarck-Mandan area and maybe even across the state, gathering to celebrate her Saturday from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. at the Mandan Eagles Club. And you can find out more searching Sue Balcom Benefit on Facebook. And for an even more personal and deeply poignant look at her journey, we encourage you to go to her blog, indiechildren.blog. Indie, as in I, not dead yet. Children, so listen up. So very Sue Balcom-like.
Let her know that I love her and that I miss her.
I certainly will.
The UN estimates about 20,000 babies have been born in Gaza since the war began. We'll hear from some moms who are having to navigate life with a newborn in a war zone.
She told me, I wish I never gave birth. I wish I didn't have this kid to come to life.
On the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
4 a.m. to 9 central here on Prairie Public.
Herbert M. Larimer was a local school teacher and community theater participant, and he constructed a historical monument in North Dakota to honor pioneers, as we'll learn in this Plains Folk essay.
In her charming book about McIntosh County, Along the Trail of Yesterday, right under Seth MacNeil's 1886 Independence Day ballad singing the praises of pioneers, appears a photograph of the stone monument to the same, a squarish obelisk alongside which stands a bullet-pocked tin sign saying, Old Settlers Monument, original site of Hoskins, first settlement, McIntosh County, established 1884, monument constructed out of local rocks and names chiseled by Herb Larimer, Ashley Pioneer. Which is mostly true. Herbert M. Larimer proved up a homestead in 1901, so he was close to an old settler, married a local girl, Margaret A. Weber, and took up school teaching in Ashley. He was well known in town, his community theater group, one night in 1904, voting him both most popular man and also the prize winner for ugliness, homeliness, and meanness. So you know they liked him. Just what possessed Larimer to construct one of the most fascinating historical monuments in North Dakota is addressed in the county's 1938 Jubilee History, which says, Desiring that he accomplish some task worthy of posterity, Mr. Larimer conceived the idea of building a memorial honoring all pioneers that they might not be forgotten. Now, if you read this history, I think you will agree there is a tongue-in-cheek tone to the passage, an intimation that the monument-making may have been as much about Mr. Larimer as it was about pioneer memory. I think I know why. In the first place, in 1918, Larimer testified for the prosecution in the trial of John Wishick, popularly known as Father Wishick, who was acquitted on charges of sedition. Also, by the time of monument construction, 1933-1935, Larimer had gone with his wife to the courthouse in Fargo, where Cass County court records confirm they divorced. This perhaps damaged his bona fides as a community member. As to the material of construction, we go back to the Jubilee history to read. All pioneers or their descendants were requested to furnish a rock with the name of the pioneer inscribed thereon. Examination of the monument shows some of them did. The chiseled names of old settlers vary stylistically, indicating multiple parties involved, including one markedly dyslexic. The stones are smooth-faced, however, so someone stone-sawed them all, and it seems likely Larimer did most of the inscribing, too. There was a ceremony of consecration in 1933 on the Hoskins Lakeshore, at the spot where once stood the schoolhouse in the center of the village. Mary Early Johnson, granddaughter of Claire D. Johnson, arguably the county's first settler and a real frontier character, baptized the inscribed stones with lake water. District Judge William H. Hutchinson from Lemoore gave an address, taking time from fighting the recall campaign in progress against him, organized by people who protested his support of farm mortgage foreclosures. Then, everyone walked off, except Larimer, who worked away on his monument until 1935. On 14th December that year, the Bismarck Tribune reported he had completed his work and placed atop it a cannonball boulder inscribed, McIntosh County, 1883-1933. The crowning boulder appears clearly in the photo in Nina Farley Wishick's book, but it is not there today. Look for yourself when you pass the monument west of Ashley between Highway 11 and the lakeshore. So besides all the other interesting details, we have a mystery. What happened to the cannonball boulder? Who has it? Bring it back. All is forgiven. In the meantime, we have the intact monument serving as an index of old settlers in the locality. This could be the basis for a fine study of the composition of local frontier community.
Tom Ezern is a distinguished professor of history at North Dakota State University. Dakota Datebook is next.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
This is Bird Note. But before Bird Note existed, John Kessler was recording the sounds of Seattle for public radio station KPLU, now called KNKX. From the ferry whistle to the space needle elevator operator.
Welcome to the elevator.
To salmon leaping in a stream. But after 100 or so of these sounds, John was feeling stumped.
I was like, what makes sound? What makes sound? And I was like, oh, wait, birds. Birds make sound.
He connected with some local birders to find the best spots in the city.
I saw some amazing stuff that I had no idea was there, like the Great Blue Heron Rookery at the Ballard Locks. They took me to hear winter wrens at a park overlooking Puget Sound. They also sent me with a grebe expert at Green Lake. 100 feet from a four-lane highway, there's these beautiful birds making their little nests on top of the lily pads.
Shortly after, Bird Note's founder, Chris Peterson, sought out John's musical ear to help create a sound-rich show highlighting the joy of birds. John worked as Bird Note's senior producer for over 18 years. Recently retired from the show, birds are still a part of John's life. He uses a recording device outside his home to keep track of his local feathered friends. And he's hoping to spend a little more time focusing on his own music. For Bird Note, I'm Mark Bramhill.
Hi, I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. Prairie Public is the place you'll hear compelling conversations, music you're excited to discover, investigative, fact-driven journalism, and sound-rich storytelling. We bring you this kind of radio with the help of listeners like you, and without the help of advertisers. Help keep non-commercial public radio thriving in North Dakota. Become a sustaining member today by just going to prairiepublic.org or call 800-359-4145. Again, that's 800-359-4145. Thanks so much.
Support for Dakota Datebook is provided by Books on Broadway and Dakota Soda and Coffee Company of Williston, featuring coffees and a wide variety of books for children and adults. Books on Broadway, the independent bookstore for independent minds.
This is Dakota Datebook for March 27th. Section 3 of the 14th Amendment of the Constitution is perhaps best known for the restrictions it places on who was qualified to be president. But there are four other sections in the amendment, and one of them directly relates to North Dakota railroads. The 14th Amendment's journey to ratification was an uncertain one. It began on this date in 1866 when President Andrew Johnson vetoed a civil rights bill. Johnson was a former Democrat from Tennessee who served as Abraham Lincoln's vice president and became president when Lincoln was assassinated. On this date in 1866, Johnson vetoed a bill that would guarantee full social, political, and economic equality for former slaves. Congress responded by proposing the 14th Amendment, which would guarantee equal rights for all citizens. It was ratified on July 28, 1868. But what about the railroads? North Dakota railroads had a history of objecting to the amount of tax they were required to pay. The state routinely enacted laws like the 1898 Anderson Tax Law, which addressed a property tax for railroads. Railroads routinely demanded hearings and brought court cases over such taxation. In 1919, they presented two arguments against the tax, that railroad property was overvalued and that it was taxed at a higher assessment than farmland. And in 1936, the Great Northern Railroad brought their fight against the North Dakota railroad tax all the way to the Supreme Court. The court relied on the first section of the 14th Amendment in deciding the case. That section says, "No state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States, nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws." The 6-3 decision went in favor of the railroad, but not entirely. The railroad did not want to pay more than 60% of the tax bill. The court said the state could charge up to 87%. Since the railroad had already paid 60%, the Great Northern still owed 27% of the original tax bill from 1933. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Ann Alquist.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding by Humanities North Dakota, North Dakota's largest lifelong learning community.
And that's a wrap for today's Main Street. Ashley and I thank all of you for joining us, and we hope that you'll join us again tomorrow.
We do, and we also encourage you to stay tuned to this evening's programming. Craig, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
While Major League Baseball scrambles to figure out a current megastar's tie to sports gambling, it's a reminder of a former star who's been down this road before. I met Pete Rose when he spoke in Riverton, Wyoming, and there'll be more on the legendary Hit King today on All Things Considered. And on Travel with Rick Steves, a veteran eclipse watcher has tips for viewing the big one on April 8th, paddling down the Mekong River in Southeast Asia.
And tomorrow on Main Street, it's a little too late for spring break, and it's definitely not time for summer travels. What can we do in this weird little in-between times? And are there ways to realize that vacation is a state of mind? We are joined by travel writer Alicia Underlee Nelson for tips on how to have a staycation and explore the parts of this state that you maybe don't think that much about, or even how to build in a little bit of ritual into your very own home. That's coming up tomorrow on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.